I came again to the altar in Albania in the evening of the calends of May. We had started late from home. By the time I had hung up the basket of food I brought with me on a tree branch to keep it from vermin, and blessed the altar place, and laid out the fleeces to sleep on, it was getting dark. Again I wished for a fire, for the cheer of it, but I had left the fire pot with Maruna. I sat and listened and watched the light die. The trees gathered and grew stronger in the dark. One owl called from the right, far off. None answered. In the great silence, my heart went down, and farther down. What a fool I was to have come here. What did I remember of my last night here? I had had a dream about a man who was dying somewhere else, in some other time. Nothing to do with me. And for that I had come back here with my silly basket of food. I lay down. I was tired and quite soon was asleep. I woke in the black, starless dark and looked past the altar. He was there. Poet, I said. He said, Lavinia. A light rain was pattering on the ground and on the leaves of the forest. It ceased and began again and ceased. He came where he had sat before, not far from me, and sat on the ground again, his arms round his knees.
Are you cold?
He asked. No. Are you?
Yes.
I wanted to offer him fleeces to keep off the rain, but I knew it was no good.
The ship is coming into harbor, he said.
His voice was gentle and humorous, charged with passion, yet quietly flowing, even when he was not singing his poem. That is what his song was called, he had told me, the first night, an epic poem.
We've passed through the arms of the harbor, where Pompey had his blockade of ships. I can feel how the rise and fall of the waves has diminished. I hated that swelling and sinking when I was out at sea, but I miss it now. We'll be ashore soon, no waves at all, only a hot, flat bed, and sweat and aching, and more fever and less fever. What an escape some kind God has given me, to be here in the dark, in the rain, to be cold, shivering. Are you shivering, Lavinia?
No, I'm fine. I didn't know what to say. I wish you were well, I said.
I'm well enough. I'm very well. I have been granted what few poets are granted. Maybe it's because I haven't finished the poem, so I can still live in it. Even while I die, I can live in it. And you can live in it. Be here. Be here to talk to me, even if I can't write. Tell me. Tell me, daughter of King Latinus, how goes it in Latium?
The spring was early. Calving and lambing went well. The spelt and barley are tall for the season. Everything is well with the panades of my house, except the salt is getting low. I'll have to go down to the salt beds at the mouth of the Father River soon and bring dirty salt back and clean it and leach it and bake it and soak it and dry it and pound it and all the rest you have to do to make it right.
How did you learn to do all that?
From the old women.
Not from your mother?
My mother is from Erdia. They don't have salt beds nearby down there. They trade for their salt with houses like ours. That's why our women know how to make it. We trade it. But the sacred salt, for the salsamola, I have to make that myself, from beginning to end.
What would you rather do?
Talk with you, I said.
What do you want to talk about?
The Trojans.
What do you want to know about the Trojans?
I had trouble getting started, but then it came out. When Troy was burning, his wife, Creusa. They were in the streets, trying to escape. He had the child. She was behind him. They got separated. The Greek soldiers killed her. And then she came to him, taller than life, there in the darkness and the burning, and told him he must go on, get out, save his people. And he tried to hold her, 3 times, but she was only air and shadow. He nodded. But later on,
You said he went down to the underworld and talked to the shadows of the dead there later on. Did he meet his wife again there? The poet was silent and then said,
No.
He couldn't find her among so many, I said, trying to imagine the dead.
He didn't look for her.
I don't understand.
Neither do I. And I doubt that I'll know any more when I get there. We each have to endure our own afterlife. He had lost her. In the fire, in the slaughter, in the streets. Lost her forever. He couldn't look back. He had his people to look after.
After a time, I asked, where did they go after they escaped from Troy?
They wandered a long time around the Middle Sea, not knowing where to go, getting it wrong. They came to Sicily and stayed a while. His father died there. They set off again to seek the Promised Land, but a storm scattered the fleet and threw the ships onto a wild coast in Africa.
And what did they do there?
Thanked the gods for safe deliverance, and got themselves some venison and feasted. And then Aeneas and his friend Achates went off to find out what country they were in, and came to a city that was just being built. Carthage, it was called, and the people were Phoenicians, and the queen was Dido, and she welcomed them.
Tell me about it. The poet seemed hesitant. I felt at once that his hesitation had something to do with the queen. He fell in love with Queen Dido, I said, and felt a curious flatness or disappointment as I said it.
She fell in love with him,
the poet said. His voice was grave.
I think this is not really a story to be told to a young girl, Lavinia.
But I am not a young girl. I am ripe now for a man, of full age now for marriage, as you said. And I am aware that married women sometimes fall in love with other men. Younger men. I doubt he heard the dryness in my voice when I said that. He was thinking about the African queen.
She was a widow. There was nothing wrong about it, except that her heart and her will ran away with her. She very much needed a king. She was an excellent ruler. Her people loved her. They were founding a beautiful city there, everything going very well. But it's a rare thing for a woman to rule long alone. It makes men uncomfortable. The neighboring kings and chiefs were after her, courting her, coveting her power, wooing and threatening at the same time. Aeneas came as her savior, her answer to them, a tried warrior with his own troops, a man born to be a king, but with no country of his own. She needed him before she loved him. She fell in love with his son first. She took to Ascanius at once, held him and hugged him and promised him good times. And of course, the motherless boy liked her, the warm-hearted, beautiful, kind, childless woman. And that went to Aeneas' heart. His son was all the family he had left. He promised to help Dido get her city started. And so, a pause.
One thing led to another, I said.
I can never get used to the fact, though I know it, that women are born cynics. Men have to learn cynicism. Infant girls could teach it to them.
I had no idea what a cynic was, but I knew what he meant. I wasn't speaking in contempt. One thing does lead to another. There's no harm in that. How else would husbands and wives ever come to love each other? She needed a man. And he was kind and noble and handsome and shipwrecked. She fell in love with him. Any woman would.
Let it be an omen,
the poet murmured. But did he fall in love with her?
Yes, he did. She was beautiful, fiery, passionate. Any man would, but...
He was still mourning for Creusa.
No. His wife, his city, that was all behind him, far back. Years and lands and seas between them. He didn't look back. But he didn't know how to look forward. He was caught in the moment,
in the present time. His father's death was a hard blow to him. He had depended on Anchises, obeyed him even when the old man led them astray. When he died and took the past with him, Aeneas felt the future was gone too. He didn't know how to go on. The storm that scattered his fleet and took them off course to lands they didn't know. There was a storm like that in his soul. He'd lost his way. What was his way? Here, to Italy, to Latium. He knew that. Why couldn't his future have been in Africa? Why shouldn't he stay and help the queen build her city and be happy with her? I spoke reasonably, though in fact I did not want him to have done that. I counted on the poet's argument. But he didn't argue. He shook his head. After a while, he said, pursuing his thought, "It was a storm that brought them together, too. While they were out hunting, they got separated from the rest of the hunting party. There was rain, hail. They took refuge in a cave. And so..."
"Did they marry?" I asked after a while.
"Dido took their love for marriage, called it marriage. He did not. He was right."
"Why?"
"Not even need and love can defeat fate, Lavinia. Aeneas' gift is to know his fate, what he must do, and do it, in spite of need, in spite of love."
"So what did he do?"
"He left her."
"He ran away?"
"He ran away."
"What did she do?"
"She killed herself."
I had not expected that. I thought she would send out ships after Aeneas, pursue him, take fiery revenge. I could not like this African queen, but I could not possibly despise her. Yet suicide seemed a coward's answer to betrayal. At last I said so.
"You do not know what despair is," the poet said gently. "May you never know."
I accepted that. I knew what despair was. It was where my mother lived after her sons died. But I had not lived there myself.
"It was a hard death," he said. "Her sword went wide of the heart, and the wound killed her only slowly. She told them to light the pyre she lay on before she was dead. He saw the great fire of it from out at sea."
"And knew what it was?"
"No.
Maybe." His soul must cringe in him every time he thinks of that. Weren't his people ashamed of him?
"Even if he'd called himself king there, it would never have been their country. And Dido had stopped building the city, dropped the reins of government. She'd lost her self-respect. She couldn't think of anything but him. Things weren't going right. They were glad to get him away from there." After a time, he said, "He did see Dido down in the underworld. She turned away. She refused to speak to him." That seemed only right. But there was an awful sadness in the story, an awful shame and sorrow, an unbearable injustice. I felt so sorry for all three of them, Creusa, Dido, Aeneas, that I could not say anything. We sat a long time in silence. "Tell me of happier things," the poet said in his beautiful, gentle voice. "How do you spend your days?"
"You know how the daughter of a house spends her days."
"Yes, I do. I had an older sister in Mantua. But this is not Mantua, and our father wasn't a king."
He waited. I said nothing. He said,
"On feast days, the chief men of the city come to dine at the king's table, and visitors from other cities of Latium, and perhaps allies from farther away, and your suitors, of course. Tell me about them."
I sat for a while in the darkness. The rain had passed over, and stars were beginning to shine overhead and through the leaves of the forest around us. "I come here to get away from them. I don't want to talk about them, please."
"Not even Turnus? Isn't he very handsome, very brave?"
"Yes."
not handsome and brave enough to move a girl's heart?
Ask my mother, I said.
At that, he was silent. When he spoke again, he had changed his tone.
Who are your friends, then, Lavinia?
Sylvia, Maruna,
some of the other girls, some of the old women.
Sylvia, who has a pet stag?
Yes, we saw it down this way, Maruna and I. It was following a doe, just like a dog after a bitch. A dog with antlers. It made us laugh.
Males in love are ridiculous, he said. They can't help it.
How do you know about Sylvia's stag?
It came to me.
You know everything, don't you?
No, I know very little. And what I thought I knew of you, what little I thought of at all, was stupid, conventional, unimagined. I thought you were a blonde. But you can't have two love stories in an epic. Where would the battles fit? In any case, how could one possibly end a story with a marriage?
It does seem more like a beginning than an end, I said. We both brooded.
It's all wrong, he said. I will tell them to burn it.
Whatever he meant, I did not like the sound of it.
And then look back from out at sea and see the great pyre flaming, I said.
He gave his short laugh.
You have a cruel streak, Lavinia.
I don't think so. Maybe I wish I did. Maybe I'll need to be cruel.
No. No. Cruelty is for the weak.
Oh, not only the weak. Isn't a master stronger than the slave he beats? Wasn't Aeneas cruel in leaving Dido? But she was the weak one.
He stood up, a tall shadow in the dimness. He paced back and forth a little. He said,
In the underworld, Aeneas met an old friend, the Trojan prince Deiphobus. Paris, who ran off with Helen, was killed in the war. So the Trojans gave Helen to his brother, Deiphobus.
Why didn't they put her out the gate and tell her to go back to her husband?
The Trojan women asked that question, but the Trojan men didn't hear it. So then the Greeks took the city, and Menelaus came looking for his wife, the woman they fought the war for, and Helen met him. She took her old husband to the bedroom where her new husband was sound asleep. He hadn't heard the sounds of battle. She hadn't wakened him. She'd stolen his sword. So he woke to his death, the Greeks stabbing him, hacking him, chopping off his hands, slicing his face in half, crazy for blood, and the woman looking on. And so Deiphobus went down into the dark. Down there, years after, Aeneas saw him, his shadow, still maimed, mutilated, unhealed. They talked a little, but the guide broke in. No time for this, Aeneas must hurry on. And the murdered man said, Go on, go, my glory. I am gone. I join the crowd, return to darkness. I hope you find a better fate. And speaking, he turned away.
I sat in silence. I wanted to cry, but had no tears.
I will be gone soon, the poet said. I will join the crowd, return to darkness.
Not yet.
Keep me here. Keep me here, Lavinia. Tell me it is better to be alive, better to be a slave living than Achilles dead. Tell me I can finish my work.
If you never finish it, it will never end, I said, speaking only to speak, saying what came into my head to give him some comfort. Anyway, how are you going to end it, if not with a marriage, with a murder? Do you have to decide how it ends before you get to the end?
No, he said. I don't, in fact. It's not exactly a matter of deciding, rather of finding out, or as it now stands, of giving up, because I haven't the strength to go on. That's the trouble. I am weak. So the end will be cruel.
He paced back and forth once, between me and the altar. I could hear no sound of his steps on the earth. But finally he sighed, a long, rather noisy sigh, and sat down again, his arms round his knees.
Tell me what you and Sylvia do, what you talk about, Tell me about her, dear. Tell me how you make the salt. Tell me when you spin, when you weave. Did your mother teach you those arts? Tell me how you unlock and clean out the storeroom early in summer, and leave it open for a few days, praying to the Penates that it be refilled with the harvest.
You know it all.
No, only you can tell me.
So I told him what he asked, and comforted him with what he knew. I spent the next day alone in the forest of Albania. The air was heavy under the trees, and the sulfur smell stopped my breath when I went near the springs. Wandering away, I found a path up the steep hill, almost a crag, that rises up over the forest. Clearings at the top gave a wide view west to the bright line that was the sea. I sat up there in the sunlight and the thin grass, my back against a fallen log. I had my spindle and a bag of wool. A woman usually carries some of her Penates with her. I was spinning the very finest thread for a summer toga or pala, so my light bag of wool would last me a good while. I sat and spun and thought and gazed out over the hills and woods of Latium, all green with May. At midday, I ate a little cheese and spelt bread and found a spring to drink from. There were shepherd's lettuce and watercress growing at the spring, and I ate that, too, though I had intended to be very sparing, even perhaps to fast. But fasting comes hard to me. Then I explored the hilltop a little more, and when the sun was halfway between high heaven and earth, I made my way down into the depths of the woods again. I passed the stinking springs on the windward side and came again to the altar place. There I slept a little, for I had had little sleep the night before. When I woke, in the dusk, big white moths were fluttering in the air within the sacred wall, rising and falling, circling round about one another in an airy maze, wonderful to see. I watched them sleepily, and through their dance I saw my poet standing near the altar. The moths look like souls in the underworld, I said, still only half awake. He said, It is a terrible place. On the far side of the dark river are marshy plains, where you hear crying, little, weak, wailing cries, from the ground, everywhere, underfoot. They are the souls of babies who died at birth or in the cradle, died before they lived. They lie there on the mud, in the reeds, in the dark, wailing, and no one comes. I was awake now. I said, How do you know that?
I was there.
You were in the underworld? With Aeneas?
Who else would I be with? He said.
He looked about uncertainly. His voice was low and dull. He went on, hesitant.
It was the Sibyl who guided Aeneas.
What man did I guide?
I met him in a wood like this, a dark wood, in the middle of the road. I came up from down there to meet him, to show him the way.
But when was that? Oh, this dying is a hard business, Lavinia. I am very tired. I can't think straight anymore.
You're not thinking straight about the babies, I said. Why would they be punished for not having lived? How could their souls be there before they had time to grow souls? Are the souls of dead kittens there, and of the lambs we sacrifice, and of miscarried fetuses? If not them, then why babies? If you invented that marsh full of miserable, dead, crying babies, it was a misinvention. It was wrong. I was extremely angry. I used the second most powerful word I know. Wrong. Nephas. Against the order of things. Unspeakable. Unsacred. There will be many words for it, but that was the one I knew. It is only the shadow, the opposite, the undoing, of the great word phas, the right, what one must do. He sat down, doubling up his tall, shadowy figure, and I could see how wearily he moved, how he bowed his head down like a man spent, defeated, but I would not have pity on him. If cruelty comes of weakness, as you said, then you are very weak, I said. He did not answer. After a long time, I said, I think you are strong. My lips and voice quivered as I spoke, for I did pity him,
though I did not want to, and my heart was full of tears.
If it is wrong, I will take it out of the poem, child, he said, if I am permitted to.
I wanted so much to be able to help him, to give him a fleece to sit on, or my toga to put round his shoulders, for he sat hunched as if he was shivering cold. But I could do nothing for him, and could touch him only with my voice.
Who is it that permits or forbids you?
The gods, my fate, my friends, Augustus.
I knew what he meant by his fate and his friends. At least I knew what the words meant. The others I was not certain of, and I did not know who his friends were and whether he could trust them. As for his fate, we none of us know that. But surely you're a free man, I said at last. Your work is your own.
It was till I got sick, he said. Then I began to lose my hold on it, and now I think I've lost it. They'll publish it unfinished. I can't stop them, and I haven't got the strength to finish it. It ends with a murder, as you said. Turnus' death. Why does it? Who cares about Turnus? The world is full of fine, fearless young men, eager to kill and be killed. There'll always be enough of them for every war.
Who kills him?
The poet did not answer my question. He only said, after a long time,
it's not the right ending.
Tell me the right ending.
Again, he was silent for a long time.
I can't, he said.
It was almost dark. Leaves and branches that had stood out sharp black against deep blue had begun to blur away into the dimness of night. Venus shone for a minute low between dark trunks in the west, and I prayed to the power of its beauty. There was no wind at all, and no bird or creature made any noise.
I think I know why I came to you, Lavinia. I have wondered, of all the people of my poem, why were you the one who called my spirit? Why not my great, my dear Aeneas? Why can't I see him with my living eyes, as I saw him so often with the eyes of my art?
His voice was extremely low, almost breathless. I strained to listen. I did not understand much of what he said then,
because I did see him, and not you. You're almost nothing in my poem, almost nobody, an unkept promise. No mending that now, no filling your name with life as I fill Dido's. But it's there, that life ungiven, there in you. So now, at the end, when it's too late, you have it to give to me. My life, my earth of Italy, my hope of Rome, my hope.
There was a desperation in his voice that wrung my heart. His words died away and he sat still, his head bowed. I could barely see him. I was afraid, knowing that he was drifting away from me into his sadness, his mortal sickness. I was afraid I would lose even his shadow. I wanted to keep him with me, though I did not and could not understand it as he did. I knew what the bond between us was, and how to use it to bring him back. I said, I want to know about Aeneas. After he left Africa, after he looked back over the water and saw her funeral fire burning, where did he go then? The poet kept his dejected posture for a while. He shook his head a little. He said hoarsely,
Sicily.
He looked around, shrugging his shoulders slowly to get the cramp out. He'd already been there, hadn't he?
He went back to celebrate the parentalia for his father. While he was in Africa with Dido, a year had passed since Anchises died.
How did he celebrate?
Properly, with ceremony and sacrifice, and then with games and competitions and a feast.
His voice had grown stronger. The music was coming back into it.
Aeneas has a very just sense of what's appropriate, and he knew his men needed heartening.
7 years wandering, and here they were back where they'd been a year ago. So he gave them games. What he forgot was the women. That hardly seems surprising. Very well, my cynic. But Aeneas is not a forgetful man. He thinks about all his people. A lot of women had entrusted themselves to him in the escape from Troy. He'd tried to make the long voyaging bearable to them. But when he announced that they were setting off yet again to seek the promised land, it was too much. Juno got into them. She goaded them. They rebelled. They went down to the shore and set fire to the ships.
What do you mean Juno got into them?
She hated Aeneas. She was always against him.
He saw that I was puzzled. I pondered this. A woman has her Juno, just as a man has his genius. They are names for the sacred power, the divine spark we each of us have in us. My Juno can't get into me. It is already my deepest self. The poet was speaking of Juno as if it were a person, a woman, with likes and dislikes, a jealous woman. The world is sacred, of course. It is full of gods, noumena, great powers and presences. We give some of them names. Mars of the fields and the war, Vesta the fire, Ceres the grain, Mother Tellus the earth, the Penates of the storehouse, the rivers, the springs. And in the storm cloud and the light is the great power called the Father God. But they aren't people. They don't love and hate. They aren't for or against. They accept the worship due them, which augments their power through which we live. I was entirely puzzled. I finally asked, why does this Juno person hate Aeneas? Because she hates his mother, Venus. Aeneas' mother is a star?
No, a goddess.
I said cautiously, Venus is the power that we invoke in spring, in the garden when things begin growing. And we call the evening star Venus.
He thought it over. Perhaps having grown up in the country, among pagans like me, helped him understand my bewilderment.
So do we, he said. But Venus also became more, with the help of the Greeks. They call her Aphrodite. There was a great poet who praised her in Latin. Delight of men and gods, he called her. Dear nurturer. Under the sliding star signs, she fills the ship-laden sea and the fruitful earth with her being. Through her, the generations are conceived and rise up to see the sun. From her, the storm clouds flee. To her, the earth, the skillful maker, offers flowers. The wide levels of the sea smile at her, and all the quiet sky shines and streams with light. It was the Venus I had prayed to. It was my prayer, though I had no such words. They filled my eyes with tears and my heart with inexpressible joy. I said at last, why would anyone hate her?
Jealousy, he said.
A sacred power jealous of another? I could not understand it. Is a river jealous of another river? Is earth jealous of the sky?
The man in my poem asks, is it the gods who set this fire in our hearts? Or do we each make our fierce desire into a god?
He looked at me. I said nothing.
Great Homer of Greece says the god lights the fire. Young Lavinia of Italy says the fire is the god. This is Italian ground. You and Lucretius have it right. Offer praise, ask for blessing, and pay no attention to the foreign myths. They're only literature. So, never mind about Juno. The Trojan women were furious at not having been consulted, and determined to stay in Sicily. And so they set fire to the ships.
That I could understand well enough. I listened.
The whole fleet would have burned if a rain squall hadn't come up and drowned the fires. They lost 4 ships. The women ran, of course, took to the hills, but Aeneas never even thought of punishing them. He realized he'd pushed them too far. He called a council and let them all choose freely, stay in Sicily, or sail with Aeneas. Old people and many women, a lot of mothers with young children, chose to stay. Others chose to keep on looking for the promised land. So, after the 9 days of the festival were done, and another day for the tears of parting, they sailed.
This way? To Latium?
The poet nodded. But first he put in at Cumae.
I knew there is an entrance to the underworld there. To go down? Why?
A vision. His father Anchises told him to come find him, across the dark river. And having always obeyed his father and the fates, Aeneas went to Cumae and found the guide and the way down.
And he saw the marsh where the babies lie crying, I said, and his friend who was murdered so cruelly that even his ghost was not healed, and Queen Dido, who turned away and wouldn't speak.
But he didn't look for his wife, Creusa. No, the poet said humbly.
It doesn't matter. I think there is no rejoining there, I said. Shadow cannot touch shadow. I think the long night is for sleeping.
Daughter of Latinus, foremother of Lucretius, you promise me what I most desire.
Sleep?
Sleep.
But your poem...
Well, my poem will look after itself, no doubt, if I let it.
We both sat in silence. It was quite dark. The wind was down. Nothing stirred. Has he left Cumae by now?
I think so,
the poet said. We spoke very low, almost in whispers.
He'll stop at Circeae to bury his nurse, Caeta, who begged to come with him, but she's old and ill, and she dies in the ship. He puts ashore to bury her. That will delay him some days.
A chill of fear had come into me. Too much was coming to me too soon. I wanted the poet to tell me what was coming, and I didn't want it. I said, I don't know when I can come back here.
Nor do I, Lavinia.
He looked across the dark air at me, and I could tell that he was smiling.
Oh, my dear, he said,
still very softly.
My unfinished, my incomplete, my unfulfilled. Child I never had, come back once more.
I will. I am not the feminine voice you may have expected. Resentment is not what drives me to write my story. Anger, in part, perhaps, but not an easy anger. I long for justice, but I do not know what justice is. It is hard to be betrayed. It is harder to know you made betrayal inevitable. Who was my true love, then, the hero or the poet? I don't mean which of them loved me more. Neither of them loved me long, just sufficiently, enough. My question is, which of them did I more truly love? And I cannot answer it. One was my husband, the beautiful man whose flesh my flesh enclosed to make my son in me, the author of my womanhood, my pride, my glory. The other was a shadow, a whisper in shadows, a virgin's dream or vision, yet the author of all my being. How can I choose? I lost them both so soon. I knew them only a little better than they knew me. And I remember always that I am contingent. So, of course, were they. It is only too likely that little Publius Virgilius Maro might have died at 6 or 7, ashes under a small gravestone in Mantua, before he was ever a poet. And with him would have died the hero's glory, leaving a mere name among 1,000 names of warriors, not even a myth on the Italian shore. We are all contingent. Resentment is foolish and ungenerous, and even anger is inadequate. I am a fleck of light on the surface of the sea, a glint of light from the evening star. I live in awe. If I never lived at all, yet I am a silent wing on the wind, a bodiless voice in the forest of Albania. I speak, but all I can say is, go. Go on. When I got home with Maruna the next day, everybody on the women's side tried to tell me simultaneously that Turnus had sent a messenger to my father, and that Queen Amata wanted to see me right away. My habit of fear of my mother made me wince inwardly at that. Yet she had not screamed at me or humiliated me in the old way for a long time now. I was ashamed of my cowardice. As soon as I had washed the dirt of travel from my feet and changed my clothes, I went to her rooms. She sent her maids away and greeted me with real eagerness, kissing my forehead and taking my hands to draw me down to sit beside her. Such a show of love might have seemed false, affected, but Amata was not a schemer. She was far too much at the mercy of her feelings to play a part she did not feel. She was truly glad to see me, and her pleasure went to my heart. I had so longed for the approval, the kindness of my beautiful and unhappy mother, that the least sign of it was irresistible to me. I sat down by her willingly. She stroked my hair. Her hand trembled a little. She was very excited. Her great dark eyes seemed full of light. King Turnus has sent a messenger, Lavinia. So all the women said. It is a formal request for your hand in marriage. She was watching me so eagerly and so closely, sitting so near, that I could do nothing but look down, speechless. I felt the blush rise to my skin, the wave of heat all over my body, and the sense of being trapped, helpless, exposed. My shrinking silence did not surprise or displease her. She took my hand and held it while she talked. It is an unusual proposal. King Turnus is a great-hearted man. He speaks not only for himself, but for other young kings and warriors who have come here courting you. Misapus, Aventinus, Ufens, and Clausus the Sabine. Turnus' message is that to avoid dispute and bad blood among these powerful subjects and allies of Latium, the time has come for the king to choose your husband from among them, and so end their rivalry. All are agreed to accept Latinus' choice. He will be sending for you soon to tell you his decision. I could do nothing but nod. It is not an easy decision for your father to make, Amata said, her voice growing less hurried and eager, warmer now that the message had been given. He's devoted to you. He doesn't want to let you go. But he's been very worried about the rivalries Turnus speaks of. He's lain awake nights, fearing that the young warriors will come to blows over you, or try to force a choice upon him that will upset the kingdom. They're like a box of tinder, those young men. One spark and they'll be in arms. And your father is proud of the peace he has kept, and wishes with all his heart to keep it. He is an old man, past fighting. He needs, in fact, the heart and strength of a young man to defend him. A son-in-law. Which of them would you think best suited to that honor? I shook my head. My throat was dry. No words would come from it. He will ask you, Lavinia. You must be ready for that. He will not want to marry you to a man you dislike. You know that. But it is time for you to marry, and past time. We can't change that. So you must choose. And it will truly be your choice. He would never go against your heart. I know. She got up and moved about the room a little. She took one of the tiny pots of scent from her table and brought it over to dab the rose oil on my wrists. It is rather nice to have young men quarreling over one, she said with a smile. I know. It seems such a pity to have to bring all that to an end. But it can't last forever. And the impossible choice, when suddenly it must be made, usually makes itself. Among them all the young possibilities, there really is only one who is possible, who is inevitable, intended. She smiled again, radiantly. I thought, she is like a girl speaking of her betrothed. I still said nothing, and she said, after waiting a minute, Well, my dear, you need not tell me your choice, but you will have to tell your father, or let him choose for you. I nodded. Do you wish us to choose for you? The eagerness was strong in her voice. I could not speak. Are you so frightened? She spoke tenderly, and sitting down by me again held me close against her,
as she had not done since I was 6 years old. I could not relax, but sat stiff in her encircling arms.
Oh, Lavinia, he will be kind to you, good to you. He is so fine, so handsome. There is nothing to be afraid of,
and you can visit back here often with him, and I'll be welcome to come visit you and Erdia. He said so to me more than once. Erdia was my home when I was a child. It is a beautiful city. You'll see. It won't be so different for you from being here. He'll look after you as your father does. You'll be so happy there. You have nothing to fear. I will go with you.
I broke loose from her embrace, stood up. I had to get free.
Mother, I will talk with father when he sends for me, I said, and hurried out of the room. There was a singing in my ears, and the burning flush had turned to a cold that ran in my bones. As I hurried along the colonnade, I saw a great commotion in the central courtyard. A lot of people all gathered around the laurel tree. I tried to get past unseen, but first Vestina and then Titus saw me, and crying, "Look, look, come look," dragged me out towards the tree. Something was up in it, far in the branches, a fat, dark animal, a huge sack of something, writhing, a cloud of smoke, dark, heavy smoke, caught in the branches. From it came a humming, droning sound. Everybody was shouting, pointing. "Bees," they shouted, "bees swarming." My father came across the court, grave, gray, and erect. He looked up at the great swarm that pulsed and sagged and reformed constantly at the summit of the tree. He glanced up at the clouds beginning to color with sunset.
"Are they our bees?" he asked.
Several voices said no. The swarm had flown in over the roofs of the city. "Like a great smoke in the sky," somebody said.
"Tell Castus," Latina said to the house slave with him. "They're gathering for the night. He'll be able to move them."
The boy darted off to fetch Castus, our beekeeper.
"It's a sign, master. It's a sign," Maruna's mother cried. "To the very crown of the tree that crowns Laurentum, they come. What is the omen?"
"What direction did they come from?"
"Southwest."
There was a brief waiting silence. My father spoke.
"Strangers are coming from that quarter, by sea perhaps. They will come to the king in his house."
As father of the household, the city, and the state, Latinus was accustomed to read omens. He used no mysterious means and preparations, as the Etruscan soothsayers did. He looked at the omen, read its meaning, and spoke it unhesitating, with grave simplicity. His people were satisfied. A good many of them stayed in the courtyard, chattering about the omen, brushing strayed, sluggish bees out of their hair, waiting to see Castus gather the swarm to take to our hives. Latinus had seen me and said,
"Daughter, come."
I followed him to his rooms. He stopped in the anteroom and stood by the small table there, facing me. The evening light was bright in the doorway.
"Has your mother spoken to you, Lavinia?"
"Yes."
"So you know that your suitors have agreed to ask me to choose your husband from among them?"
"Yes."
"Well," he said with a forced smile, "will you tell me which one you wish me to choose?"
"No." I did not speak insolently, but the refusal took him aback. He studied me a minute.
"But there is one of them you prefer."
"No, father."
"Not Turnus?"
I shook my head.
"Your mother has told me that you love Turnus."
"No."
Again he was surprised, but he was patient with me. He said gently,
"Are you quite certain, my dear? Your mother has told me that you've been in love with him since he first came courting you, and she warned me you'd be timid about admitting it. Such timidity is right and proper in a virgin girl. We need say nothing more about it. All you need do is indicate that you will be content if I accept him for you."
"No."
Now he was puzzled and uneasy.
"If not Turnus, then which of the others?"
"None."
"You want me to refuse them all?"
"Can you, father?"
Looking grim, he took a turn round the room. He hunched his broad, muscular shoulders, rubbed his hand over his chin. He had not shaved yet,
and the gray bristles stood out on his jaw. He stopped again, facing me.
"Yes, I can," he said. "I am still king of Latium." "Why do you ask that?"
"I know that Turnus' offer contained a threat."
"It can be taken so. You need not concern yourself with that. What do you want? What do you intend, Lavinia? You're 18. You cannot go on indefinitely as a maiden at home."
"I would rather be a Vestal than marry any of those men." "We call a woman a Vestal who chooses not to marry or is never chosen, who stays with her father's family and keeps the hearth fire alight." He sighed, looking down at his big, scarred hand on the table. I think he had to resist the temptation of that idea, that hope to keep me with him. He finally said,
"If I were not king, if I had other daughters, if your brothers had lived, you might have that choice. As it is, as my only child, you are bound to marry Lavinia. You carry my power in you, our family's power, and we can't pretend you don't."
"One more year."
"It will be the same choice in a year."
I had no answer to that.
"Turnus is the best of them, daughter. Misapus will always be under Turnus' thumb. Aventinus is a fine lad, with his lion-skin coat, but he hasn't much sense. You can't live your life up in Ufens Mountains, and I won't send you off among those shifty Sabines. Turnus is the pick of the lot. He's probably the best man in Latium. He's running his kingdom well, he's feared as a fighter, he's rich, and good-looking. I know all the women think so. And he's a relation. Your mother tells me he's wildly in love with you."
He looked at me hopefully, but I would not return his gaze.
"She tells me all the praises he sings of you. She believes he's so determined to have you that if I give you to one of the others, he'll rebel, despite this agreement they made. She may be right. He's an ambitious, self-confident fellow, but he has reason to be. Your mother has encouraged him. In fact, if you picked one of the others, she might rebel."
He tried to make it a joke, but it was not a joke, and I could see misery in his eyes.
"She has your welfare and the good of our kingdom very much at heart," he said.
I had no argument, no answer. "Give me 5 days, father," I said. My voice came out hoarse and weak.
"And then you will tell me your choice."
"Yes." He took me in his big arms then and kissed my forehead. I felt the warmth of his body and smelled the familiar smell of him, harsh, dear, and comforting as the smell of the earth on the hills of summer.
"You are the light of my eyes, daughter," he murmured.
That made me cry. I kissed his hand and ran back to the women's side in tears. Everybody was in the courtyard in the twilight, watching Castus talk the swarm together into a great humming dark globe over the fountain, shadowy, swaying, shrinking together always closer and smaller, as he talked his spells and made his net ready to capture the bees.